When Larry Wohlgemuth was a child, he was sexually abused. The memories of the abuse were buried in his mind, but the consequences stayed with him every day of his life. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. After years of struggle, drug and alcohol abuse, lost jobs, and failed marriages, Larry Wohlgemuth was finally able to confront his past and move into the future. He has written about his life in the book Larry Tells Stories, A Journey of Sexual Abuse, PTSD, and Recovery. I'll talk with him, and I'll also talk with Kathy Loewenberg, who counsels victims of sexual abuse. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today's program deals with some very difficult and disturbing topics. If you're listening this morning with children in the area, it would be a good idea to turn the radio off. When Larry Wohlgemuth was a young child, he was routinely sexually abused by his grandmother's second husband. He buried those memories, but he still had to deal with the consequences every day. He has told his painful story in the new book, Larry Tells Stories, A Journey of Sexual Abuse, PTSD, and Recovery. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Kathy Loewenberg, who counsels victims of sexual abuse in Iowa City. But we'll start with Larry and his story. Good morning, Larry.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being willing to be on the show today.
You bet.
I want to start with asking you why you decided to share your story, because writing it down, going through all the details, must have been extremely difficult.
It was. The reason I wrote the book, back in 1992, when all the memories started coming out, I desperately needed somebody to identify with, somebody that had experienced this and had resolved it. So I asked my therapist if it was possible to find a book on this subject, and her answer was no. So I went to all the bookstores and I asked them, and I searched diligently. There were no books. This is a very lonely situation. People tend to not chat about it at the barbershop and places like that. And so I'm going through something all by myself. Something horrid all by myself. And I decided at that point, if I ever got out of this, that I was going to write it down so that somebody else that was going through this would have something to look at and say, oh, this guy's been where I've been and he made it out. Maybe I can too.
Well, let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
You were 3 years old. And you had a baby brother and an older sister. You had a mom who was on her own with you guys quite a bit because your dad had to travel for work and she needed help. And she turned to your grandmother for help.
Right.
And your grandmother came with a new husband, newish husband. Tell me about him.
He was a strange man. He was a giant. At least he seemed like it to me. He was well over 6 foot tall, 220, 230 pounds. He was Danish. He was everything you think of this giant Danish man. But there was something wrong with him. It was just pretty obvious that the guy wasn't right. My grandmother met him. He was living in the poor farm in Washington County, Kansas. And for some reason, she decided that this was what she was supposed to do, so she married this guy. And we found out, as kids, we found out years later that his own children had accused him of sexually abusing them. This was not new behavior. It was just in those times nobody talked about this kind of stuff.
When you were staying with your grandmother and her husband, he had a way of getting you alone.
Yep. He was a welder by trade. He had converted his garage into a shop, and he had all kinds of equipment out there, drill presses, lathes, saws, you name it. It was out there. And my brother was too young, but he would say he's going to take me out into the shop to play. And what he would do is he'd give me a hammer and a board with a couple of nails and let me pound the nails into the board. But, I mean, that was just the ruse to get me out there. His goal was to rape and sodomize me, and that's what happened. Grandma was not allowed into the shop. It was a rule. Women in that day, women had a place that was in the kitchen. The men had the workplace. He had even set up an intercom system, even though it was only a few steps from the kitchen to the garage. Grandma had to call him on the intercom. She wasn't even allowed into the shop. So he had set this up. This was not an accident. He knew what he was doing.
When this first happened, of course, you were a very small child. And you tell in the book that not only were you raped, but then you soiled yourself. And so after this happened, you were chastised for having an accident.
Absolutely. And this was regular. This was not a unique situation that happened only once. It took me a long time before I was able to contain the terror and not have these kinds of experiences.
And he threatened you to not tell anyone.
That is pretty common among pedophiles. They do that. He would put my head on the drill press with my face up and turn it on and bring the drill bit down to within an inch or two of my eye. And then he had threatened to drill holes in my head if I told anybody. Now, he had just raped me. I had no reason to believe that he wouldn't drill holes in my head, too. So being 3 and 4 years old, I did what I was told, and I kept my mouth shut.
Right. You finally did tell your mother, though.
I did. I had problems with constipation, and I would bleed from the rectum. That was caused by a tear that was a result of penetration. And the doctor said that I just waited too long to go to the bathroom, that if I went when I first needed to go, I wouldn't have this problem. And my mom was really exasperated with me and wanting to know, why did I wait so long? And I finally, I just couldn't take it anymore. I was tired of getting blamed. And I said that the reason my bottom hurt was because Grandpa put his penis in my bottom. When you're 5 years old and you make a statement like that, it gets lots of people's attention. And
as it should. And your mother did the right thing at that point.
At that point, when Dad came home that weekend, they had a talk. The decision was made that we were going to keep the kids away from my grandparents' house. And it was a fairly peaceful 18 months after that we didn't see my grandparents at all.
Except that in that time, another problem developed, and that was that your mother demanded, encouraged your father to get a job where he was home more, and he was miserable, and he was an alcoholic, and he was drinking more, and he began to beat you.
He did. My dad had his own PTSD issues. He was he joined the Merchant Marines during World War II when he was 14. He was on a ship where he was gang raped. So he had his own PTSD raging issues. And there would come a point where he needed to get that out of him. And what he would do is beat on one of us kids. Well, I was selected by Mom to be the one that took the beating. She had assumed that I was the only one strong enough to take that beating, and so that became my responsibility as part of a member of that family, was to allow Dad to get all of that out so that he could go about functioning normally in the world.
So she protected your sister, telling your dad that he couldn't hit a girl. She protected your little brother because he was the baby. He was too young. But she put you in that line of fire.
Right. And honestly, I think that she was only doing what she had seen happen in her house as a child. I think her brother, there were two girls and one boy, and I think her brother was the one who served that purpose in her family. And that's all she knew how to do. I find we're not really clever. We like to think as a species we are. For the most part, we just simply repeat what it is we've learned as children and seen. And I think that's all she was doing. I don't think that she was malevolent. I think she just didn't know better.
As things continued to deteriorate in your family, you started to have serious money problems and found that, again, your parents needed help. They needed support. And with no one else to turn to, they turned back to Grandma.
It was their only source of funds. Mom could have gotten out of the house and worked. Dad wouldn't allow it. It was something he always swore would never happen. No wife of his would ever work outside the home. And the banks and credit unions had turned them down, and so there was only one place to get money. And my grandparents had money, so they made a compromise.
The compromise was you.
Compromise was me. And this is something, when you get into child sexual abuse and you start reading different case studies, there's almost always a betrayal. There is somebody that knew that didn't say anything. There is somebody that was tasked with certain responsibilities that shirked those responsibilities. So my case is not unique in that regard. It happens to sound really bad that money was a precipitating issue, but there are people that ignore the abuse because that would mean they would have to get rid of the boyfriend or girlfriend, and rather than live alone, they just let them stay in the house and continue doing what they're doing.
You're older at this point. Your mother, it has to really... To let this continue, she undercuts your credibility with everyone that you know, by telling them that Larry tells stories. This isn't true. This isn't happening.
There was precedent I had told her, and I'm sure that she had to believe if I told her, I would probably tell someone else. And so the best way that she could avoid that situation was to place doubt in other people's minds, the neighbors, let them know, Larry says things that aren't true. And it stuck. I mean, nobody ever stopped to think, how does a five-year-old boy come up with the story that a grown man is sticking his penis in his bottom? How could you ever relate that? You just don't. You don't know enough about sexuality at that point to make that connection,
right.
but people believed it.
Larry, we need to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Larry Wolgamuth about his new book, Larry Tells Stories, A Journal of Sexual Abuse, PTSD, and Recovery. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're talking about sexual abuse of children. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by a counselor, Kathy Loewenberg, who counsels victims of sexual abuse. She's with Counseling for Growth and Healing in Iowa City. Right now, my guest is Larry Wolgamuth, who has agreed to share his very personal, very painful story. We're talking about some very disturbing things today. And I want to warn you, if you are listening with children this morning, this is probably not an appropriate conversation to listen to with them. Larry has just written about his story in the new book, Larry Tells Stories, A Journey of Sexual Abuse, PTSD, and Recovery. And Larry, before the break, we were talking about how, because of dire financial circumstances in your family, you were basically returned to this sexual predator who had abused you in your past. Your mother knew that you would be abused again, but your family needed money. So here you were being brutally beaten by your dad on a regular basis. You were being sexually abused by your step-grandfather on a regular basis. And you didn't have anybody to turn to.
Nobody. I was alone. The people that were tasked with making sure I had a safe environment were the ones that were doing the damage. So there was really no place for me to turn.
When did the sexual abuse end?
It ended when I was 10. I remember that event, the aftermath only. It must have been particularly brutal because I was in some other state for the entire day. I did not. It was like I was in shock, and I didn't come out of it until the next morning. And I think that at that point, when my dad came and picked me up from my grandparents' house, he took one look at me and he said, "I can't ever let this happen again." And I was never returned over to their house without my parents being there.
That finally came to an end. Your father was still beating you, though.
Yes.
And all through this time, you're a regular kid. You're going to school. You're getting good grades. But you do have a moment that shows outwardly what is going on with you. And this is a moment you had a mail carrier, a mailman, who was mean to your dog.
Yeah.
Tell me what happened.
Oh, my. I mean, that an 11-year-old child would see this as the way to resolve problems probably speaks volumes. The mailman used to just torment the dog horribly through the screen door. And one day the dog hit the latch and got out, chased him over into the next yard. I was out right behind him. My baseball bat was leaning up against the wall by the door. I grabbed it as I went out. I was behind the mailman. I had the bat raised over my head, and I swung it down as hard as I could. Fortunately for me, my mother had heard all the ruckus and had followed me out the door, and she grabbed the bat just as I was getting ready to swing it down. Otherwise, at the age of 11, I'd have been in the criminal justice system.
Your dad at that point seems to decide that maybe hitting you is not a good idea. So the physical abuse pretty much ends then, too.
It ends then. The story did have one positive outcome, and that's that the physical beating stopped. I guess Dad looked at me and thought, I shouldn't anger this kid anymore. He's to the point where he will retaliate.
And you, as you grew, remembered nothing of this. Not even the beatings from your dad. You managed to suppress all of these memories.
The mind is powerful and can shut out a lot of things, and I used a lot of obsessive compulsive behaviors to help. The other thing is that when you experience these kinds of traumatic events, the body releases all kinds of stress hormones, particularly cortisol. And what happens is it makes it hard for memories to imprint on the brain. So when you come out the other end, all you might have anyhow are little fragments that can be ignored. Or you can wonder, what's that memory about? And I had lots of those. Why do I remember this? What possible importance could this have in the whole scheme of things? So it becomes necessary to continue on to shut out all that has happened in the past. And I am not alone. Lots of people do this.
You also, as a high school student, started turning to alcohol.
It works. It really does. People wonder why folks turn to alcohol. If you've got these kinds of things in your background, it works. It does away with the pain.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't know why you wanted to feel numb.
Had no idea. I just knew when I was consuming alcohol, I felt normal. All the anger and anxiety and frustration and everything else that bothered me went away, and I had a chance to feel just like I thought normal felt.
You were a talented athlete. you were obviously, you are very bright, and you had been a good student early in your educational career, and you, even with all the drinking, managed to graduate from high school and just kind of skate by. And you went to college, although, again, there the drinking, marijuana interfered with your school and with your future. You talk about how you were always looking for that opportunity to start over.
Yeah, it's a pretty normal thing for alcoholics and drug addicts. Sometimes people do geographic changes. They will move to a new town and think that this is the opportunity that they have sought all their lives, and I can get to this place and straighten my life out. The problem is we're the problem. It's not where we are. It's not where we work. It's not who we're married to. None of those things are the problem. We're the problem. What's going on inside of us is the problem. And if you don't remember what happened, it's kind of hard to identify what might be the problem, and that is that all this horrible stuff happened to me.
You left college. You got married. A girlfriend of yours had gotten pregnant, and you guys decided to stay together, to get married. You also joined the military, and this was during Vietnam, right?
It was during Vietnam.
As you're in the Air Force, not a particularly distinguished career in the Air Force, and you're finding a lot of opportunities,
no.
Right?
I was your classic military malcontent. I looked at it as an honor to gum up the works. But you have to understand, it was how I felt about authority. Mm-hmm. And the military is all about authority. Well, you know, my best thinking tells me to join the military, which is all about authority, when I hate authority. It made no sense. I'm sure there were lots of people scratching their heads wondering what was I thinking.
You did find a lot of opportunities in the military to drink a lot, to smoke a lot of marijuana, to have a lot of extramarital relations. At some point, though, you started to realize that you needed help of some kind. Although I think the impression I get is that you really had no idea what you needed help with. But there's this very telling moment that you write about when you see one of the military psychiatrists, and he diagnosed you with combat fatigue, even though you had never been in combat.
Right. And it was an accurate diagnosis because combat fatigue was what they called PTSD before they had really determined what PTSD was. So this guy was right. I didn't understand how he could be because I'd never been in combat. The people at the mental health clinic didn't understand it. They could look and see I had all the symptoms, but they couldn't understand why.
As your life went on in a fairly loveless marriage, again, the cycle of alcohol and drug abuse holding you, left the military, you would hold a job for a little while and then leave it before you'd get fired, or, you know, move on from place to place to place. You finally went in to treatment for alcohol abuse and for drug abuse.
Right.
And that seems like that was the beginning of starting to learn what had happened to you.
It took away all of the self-medication that I had been doing. Alcohol and drugs work very well at keeping those memories at bay. And when the alcohol and drugs are gone, then there's the moment that you come to realize that all the OCD behaviors, all this other stuff that I was doing that helped me to control these memories, they just don't work anymore. And sooner or later, they come out.
As you worked through recovery and continued to work with a therapist, at what point did you start to have memories that revealed to you that there were things in your past that were really horrifying?
I'd been sober about 4.5 years, and one day I went home from work. I had been feeling odd for a couple of weeks, but I went home from work and I took off my suit and tie, And I laid down on the couch, and I didn't move for 3 weeks. I was just immobile. Barely bathed, didn't eat much, never left the house other than to go to my therapy appointment. I mean, I basically had just retreated into a cocoon. And my ex-wife came home one day and said, look, you either got to go back to work or you've got to go in the hospital, one of the two. You have no choices. So I called the psychiatrist that I had been seeing, explained it to him. He wasn't surprised. I imagine that my wife had already called him. And he put me into a short-term acute care psychiatric unit for 10 days. And it was, as soon as I got into the psychiatric unit, I guess I must have felt safe because that's when the memories started coming out.
As these memories started flooding back, your post-traumatic stress also became more acute.
Oh, it went off the charts. My hands shook so badly, I couldn't feed myself. Lost bowel and bladder control. I could be flooded with stress hormones at any minute, and I would need to use the bathroom. I couldn't get more than a minute away from a bathroom. I would have raging behaviors where it's out of the blue. I would grab something and start smashing it. It was just like I no longer controlled my body, that somebody else was in control. And what it was my mind reacting to all these things that had happened and wanting to keep me safe from a threat that really wasn't in front of me anymore. The threat wasn't there, but my mind didn't know that. So it was going to act like it needed to save me.
You finally knew what it was that had caused you so much trouble for so long, but that knowledge plunged you deeper and deeper into this despair. And you start the book on Christmas Day of 1994, and you went out to kill yourself that day.
Every intent. It was time to end the pain. And I'm out there on Christmas Day. Everybody else is with their families. It's dead still. There is no wind. The fog's so heavy I couldn't see but 100 feet tops in front of me. Peaceful, quiet. I spend all day at the lake fishing, catching fish, and then I sit on the side of the boat with the cinder blocks I'd put in wrapped around me, tied with rope and a gun in my mouth, and I was going to do it, and the pain was going to be gone. It had been almost 3 years at this point. I needed the pain to be gone. I couldn't take it anymore.
And your therapist cut you loose? Your psychiatrist moved away because they felt they couldn't do anything else for you at that point. So you were on your own for a number of years.
I was on my own. Honestly, and I don't recommend this as a treatment protocol, what saved me was I started drinking again. And I'd taken all their medicines. I had done everything they told me to do. I'd spent 3 years in therapy, picking the scab every week when I went in there. But honestly, what I needed was some time where it didn't hurt and alcohol worked. It works. People wonder why folks go back to drinking alcohol after they've quit. If they've got these issues, alcohol works. It kills the pain and it gives you some respite.
Finally, years after years of this, and again, failed relationships and jobs had gone by the wayside, you'd lost contact really with your kids. You've contact that original therapist that had worked with you for 3 years again, and she gives you a brand new recommendation.
She said there was a therapy that she had been working with for several years called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's commonly known as EMDR therapy. And she suggested I find a practitioner here in the Des Moines area. Found a man named Rich Jones. He is an angel. I love him. I went in and did EMDR therapy, and it was like I had been carrying a backpack full of bricks around. And each time I went to see him, another one of the bricks was taken out of the backpack. And that backpack got lighter and lighter. And one day, my symptoms were gone.
And you were able to move forward for the first time in your life.
First time. And, I mean, I don't smash furniture anymore. I don't have raging behaviors. I can go into a room full of people and sit in the front row because I don't have to be afraid about who's behind me. All these things that most people take for granted that I couldn't do. And I'm able to do all this stuff now, and it's incredible. I can't tell you how wonderful it is to be able to be a normal human being.
Well, Larry, I'm so glad you've reached this point in your journey, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you, Charity. I appreciate it.
Larry Wolgemuth is the author of Larry Tells Stories, A Journey of Sexual Abuse, PTSD, and Recovery. He lives in Ankeny. In just a moment, we'll be joined by a counselor, Kathy Loewenberg of Counseling for Growth and Healing in Iowa City. Her specialty is working with victims of sexual abuse. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about sexual abuse, particularly of children. We've been talking with Larry Wolgemuth about his book and his story, his life story. The book is called Larry Tells Stories, Journey of Sexual Abuse, PTSD, and Recovery. And we've asked a counselor who works with victims of sexual abuse to join us now. Kathy Loewenberg is with Counseling for Growth and Healing in Iowa City. Kathy, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I think it's really impossible to know how common sexual abuse is among mm-hmm. children. Can you give us an idea?
Mm-hmm. Well, the most recent statistics say one in every four females has been sexually abused, and that means in any form, by the age of 18, and one in five males. We will never know exactly.
Right.
I think that it's even more common than that. And I know there's a lot of myths surrounding sexual abuse. For instance, sibling abuse isn't very common. Oh, my gosh, it's so very common, so.
Okay. In talking about Larry's story, I mean, clearly that was an extreme case where he was really, truly, horribly abused and repeatedly, and he was in this abusive situation for many years. So we should make it clear that in talking about those numbers, we're talking about the entire spectrum.
Exactly. Everything from a child who is molested once to a child who is raped repeatedly to a child who is sadistically abused, including in sexual ways. So yes, it's the entire gamut.
Teachers and parents and, everyone who loves children and works with children looks for signs that something is going wrong with mm-hmm. a child. What are some of the signs that you can pick up on if a child's in a situation where they are being abused?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think teachers and everybody who works with children should have special training for it. And I know that that's not what they signed up for when they wanted to teach third grade. However, it's so common that they need it. A first initial sign might be a sudden change in personality. And I say may because some children are asymptomatic and you literally cannot tell. But, if you have an outgoing, vivacious child who's very interested in their schoolwork and is very connected with peers and all of a sudden isn't, is hanging back, maybe looking sad or not, maybe being overly compliant all of a sudden, or simply just starting to fail school, that would be a sign. Also, if the child is squirmy, in their seat, they're obviously uncomfortable, physically uncomfortable, that might be a sign. Also, sexual abuse often goes along with emotional abuse and sometimes physical. So we look for all signs of abuse as well. And it depends on the age. You know, all children touch their genitalia. I mean, babies do before they're born. So, but if a child, certainly if a school-age child is engaging a same-age peer or a younger child in sexual activity, and what I mean engaging as in asking for sexual contact, telling another child to take down their pants, or trying to guide the younger child into a place where the two would be alone, that's a huge sign. And then the classic one that parents have asked me for years, and I almost – children don't know something that they haven't been taught or seen. Okay, a young child doesn't know about most adult sexual activity. There's no way to know. So the question I'm asked a lot, oh, I saw my daughter humping her teddy bear. Should I be concerned? Of course, the response is, where did your child see that? It's not something the child would start to do. Or if they act out with their dolls, some kind of activity. Because children will reenact what they've seen that they don't understand. It's called traumatic reenactment. And they will do it exactly the way they believe they saw it on a video or that what happened to them. So we just need to be aware. Children will draw it in art class. They will draw genitalia. And a child who hasn't been sexually abused but has, you know, seen their mom or dad naked once or something is not going to go to school and draw genitalia, you know. But if they've been abused, then it creates a traumatic memory, and it's very clear in their minds, and they will draw it over and over and over till they get really good at it. Seriously.
So once you start picking up on the signs of a child in your world that, mm-hmm. that maybe there's something wrong, mm-hmm. what do you do?
Well, when I see children who've been sexually abused, it's because somebody already knew about it. So they're brought to me because either the child has disclosed or the child is showing signs that the parent picks up and brings the child to me and says, I don't know, there's something very different. So,
well, and I'm asking, what if a teacher picks up on these signs or if a parent picks up on these signs, what okay. can they do
okay.
first?
So if it's a teacher, the teacher should contact the parent and say, I see a difference in Susan or whatever the child's name is. You know, is anything different happening at home? She should share the signs with the parent and ask if the parent has seen those things. And if the teacher believes this is something that really needs attention, she should recommend to the parent that the child see a child therapist for further assessment, because you definitely don't want to let it go on untreated. As far as treatment goes, the very first step is safety. It's extremely important whether this victim is 3 or 63, is that person is in an environment where they are safe from further abuse and where they are being believed. And this is where the therapist and the Department of Human Services or corrections or whatever sometimes clashes. Because it's very important that that child is in an environment where they really – they cannot be re-victimized in any way. That's important.
So you're saying that can be a difficult thing to do, to accomplish.
It can be. Yes, it can be. Over time it is, yes.
When you start working with a child who has been sexually abused – I realize that with different children of different ages. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the small children, mm-hmm. because that does happen. And you have clients who are very young. What do mm-hmm. you do mm-hmm. to help them?
Well, again, first of all, I help them to feel safe. We have a few sessions where they just simply get used to the playroom. They learn to feel safe with me. They know that they get a lot of choices in there. They're not going to be tricked or coerced into doing anything. Or saying anything, you know. So that's the first thing. And they see me talking to their parent, the non-abusive parent, that we're not going to have any secrets. We talk about secrets and how those can hurt people. And we don't have any secrets. And I tell them, I don't have any secrets from your mom or whoever brought you. And every week we're going to talk about, you know, how we played maybe and what fun we had. Then I use art therapy with young children. Well, children up to 12 or 13, And that is, to the best of their ability, we begin as far away from the traumatic event as possible. So it may be draw yourself, draw you and your best friend, and then maybe draw you and the non-offending parent. I need to see how they function, you know. And then if I say, let's draw your family, and I know that one of those people in the family is the perpetrator, they most often will leave that person out of the picture. And I will say, well, what about your brother or your whoever it is? And then they might say, oh, I don't like that person. And we might say, well, what is it you don't like about them especially? You know. So anyway, it's a long process. The younger the child, the shorter the process. The problem comes in treatment is that the length of time, whether the victim is victimized at 5 or at 15 or at 25, the length of time between the victimization and treatment is the problem area, because all survivors of child sexual abuse have to go on living. So they find ways of doing that. And one young lady a few years ago who was in detention when I first found her, but anyway, I said, how in the world did you cope with being raped by your adoptive brother for all those years before you managed to do something illegal and get yourself in the system? By the way, good for you, honey. You know. And she said, and I quote, I took every drug I could get my hands on. And I said, tell me what the names. And she told me. I mean, she said, I could not live with the pain, and so I did what I had to do. And that included, in the end, running away and ending up with what law enforcement called gangs. And good for her, because she ended up in the system and nobody had ever noticed any symptoms in her. Nobody had ever asked her what was wrong, you know.
So she got to a place where she could get help. When you're working with a child, what is your goal?
My goal is complete healing, that the child knows that, first of all, what happened was not their fault in any way. People who sexually abuse children are very much alike in a lot of ways. And the things that tell children are very, very similar. Things like, you like this, don't you? Or, you want to play that game again? Remember what you get after the game? You know, I make popcorn for you, or something like that. I really like you. You're special. I don't know. Lots of things they say.
Emotional manipulation.
Emotional manipulation, and they use the word we. Now, when we do this, or when we finish so-and-so. So they engage the victim so that the victim feels as though somehow it's their idea. And the problem comes that once the child is victimized, then the perpetrator feels like they've really got a hold on them, because they can say things like, you know, your mom, she'd probably leave you if she knew what we did. Or, your dad would be so angry. You know how angry he gets? He's probably really going to be mad at you. And so little children are so innocent and so vulnerable. They believe all of the stuff they're told. And so they don't tell often. They simply don't tell because they're so afraid of the consequences of telling. So they have to live with the abuse, and then they have to live with the way they're coping with it. And then they get in trouble for the ways they're coping with it, like starting fights at school because they're angry, or regressing wetting the bed again, or failing school, all kinds of things. Life just falls apart because the world they knew no longer exists and never will.
So by complete healing, what do you mean exactly by that? I mean, obviously you are going to help them understand that they aren't responsible mm-hmm. for what happened to them. Mm-hmm. But how do you work through that pain?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, safety. I work with the parents, if it's a child, to help the parents understand that maybe if the child is sexually acting out, like masturbating in public areas, not with a sibling, that we make very, very sure that this child, this victim, is never left alone with another child, because they will often act out. That the parent understands that this child needs lots of love and support, that the child needs to be able to talk about it. But in terms of therapy, it's cognitive behavioral. You know, it's understanding that looking at the lies that the perpetrator told you, t- told them that that was all not true. They tricked you. Little children don't even understand the concept of tricking. They really don't understand that this person tricked them in any way. And so we go through all of that process. And also I focus on their strengths. If there's a child who can sing or dance or read or write or do anything, I work with the family to make sure that they get to focus on those strengths and live as normal a life as possible during the healing process so that when the pain subsides, they are a whole person that can go forward. And I say you are a wonderful, brilliant, normal human being that had a very terrible thing happen to you and you're learning how to deal with that. But when the pain goes away, you will be there in all your wholeness, and that's the goal.
Is this something that a child, as they grow into adulthood, can entirely leave behind?
The memory of it is there. They'll always remember what happened, you know. But if treatment is timely and if it's good, I don't know how else to say that, you know, they can leave it behind them. They can say, it's a terrible thing and I hope it never happens to anybody and that was a terrible time in my life, but it was an event and I'm okay.
What advice would you give to parents and other people who want to protect kids? Because as we talked about earlier, this is so common. And we hear these stories in the media about, you know, the abusers taking advantage of mm-hmm. running a program for children or the Boy Scouts, all of this stuff that, you know, terrifies parents because yes. you do want to let your child go into the world yeah. and participate in activities. Mm-hmm. But what advice can you give parents yes. for keeping their kids safe?
Right. Okay. First of all, we want to parents to know they should listen to their children. And that means really listen, as in stop what you're doing, make eye contact, and listen to the words. If the child says, Mommy, I don't really like my gym teacher, instead of saying, oh, he's the nicest guy I ever met. He's been there for years. You just need to buckle up, girl. Say, what is it you don't like about that person? Exactly. Go and talk to the teacher. See if there's something there. If the child doesn't like the babysitter, get a different babysitter. You know, there's a reason. Children don't know they don't know that what's happening to them is a crime. They don't even know it has a name. So they can't tell you what's happening. The other thing is talk with your children and teach them the correct names for their body parts and that what the body parts are for. You know, the mouth is for talking or eating and ears and so forth. And teach them the correct names for their genitalia and say clearly, every day, there are parts of your body that are private and no one should touch those parts except you or maybe the doctor, you know, if you have to go to the doctor, but nobody else. And if anybody ever does or asks you to touch theirs or shows you their private parts, you need to come and tell me right away because it's not your fault and I will not be angry because that's what children worry about, disappointing their parents or being in trouble.
Do you also warn them not to keep secrets if they're asked?
Oh, absolutely. And I always say, and I use this, the different, how you can tell a good person from a bad person. I know that sounds harsh, but I say good people will listen to you. If you say, I don't want to be tickled anymore, they'll stop. If you say, no, I don't want to go into that room with you, they'll say, okay. If somebody forces you, that's not good.
Kathy, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Kathy Loewenberg is a counselor who works with victims of sexual abuse. She works at Counseling for Growth and Healing in Iowa City. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. You can send us email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow it's Horticulture Day. We're going to talk about Christmas trees. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.